Herzlich willkommen, liebe Formel 1-Fans, zu Formel Schmidt. Die Vorfreude auf die Saison 2020 steigt weiter an. Um die Zeit zu überbrücken, haben wir noch ein paar Interviews für euch in petto. John Watson, der Vize-Weltmeister von 1982, hat 152 Grand Prix-Starts erlebt. Sein beeindruckendstes Rennen? Long Beach 1983. Von Startplatz 22 zum Sieg. Unser Formel 1-Experte Michael Schmidt hat John Watson besucht, um mit ihm über die guten alten Zeiten zu reden, aber auch Watsons Ansichten zur heutigen Formel 1 zu hören. Viel Spaß bei Michael Schmidt trifft John Watson.
Hallo liebe Motorsportfreunde, ich begrüße Sie zu einer weiteren Folge unserer Serie Formel 1 Stammtisch mit Rennfahrern von früher. Heute sind wir zu Gast bei John Watson, beinahe Weltmeister 1982, fünffacher Grand Prix-Sieger und bis heute hält er einen Rekord, der wahrscheinlich nie mehr gebrochen wird. Er hat in Long Beach vom 22. Startplatz aus ein Rennen gewonnen. Nie kam ein Sieger von weiter hinten. Hello John, nice to have you here and thank you very much for inviting us to your home to do this interview.
Michael, it's a pleasure. Welcome to 6 Delamere Way, Oxford.
Yeah.
Not maybe the home of a racing driver, not like Monte Carlo, not somewhere sexy or glamorous, but as they say, it's home. Yeah. And I'm very comfortable living in this part of Oxford. And it does have a bit of motor racing history. Yeah. In fact, all around there's a lot of Formula One.
You have retired since a long time. What are you doing now?
Well, you say retired. I never formally retired as a driver. I just stepped back from it.
Okay. I think the what's the difference?
Well, for me, if you retire, it's a finite step.
Mm-hmm.
And certainly in my period as a driver, I noticed a number of drivers would decide to retire. And then after about 2 weeks, they got itchy feet. What am I doing? I can't stay in the house all the time. Wife's driving me mad. The kids are crying. And they look for something to do. When my Formula One career, in effect, stopped at the end of 1983, there was a period through 84 where I was helping a little bit with what Porsche were doing with the 956, the Rothmans Porsche, and in fact did, in end of 84, a race in Fuji with Stefan Beloff, wherein Stefan won the driver's championship and we won the race.
Mm-hmm.
And Stefan was a very special guy, especially in a Porsche. So what I found was an outlet after Formula One to enable me to what I call tapering down from being a Formula One driver and the intensity that a Formula One driver would enjoy, you know, the excitement, the just the whole essence of being in Formula One was very special. And to go cold turkey didn't appeal. So being able to taper down my motor racing through Group C and for 1 year in America with BMW and IMSA worked very well for me. And then by the time we got to the end of the 80s, I was then in my early middle 40s, you're beginning to become too old to be realistic about being a top-end driver, whether it's in Group C or whatever you might choose to do. But also, at the same time, opportunities were coming to me in regard to doing some broadcasting, particularly at Grand Prix, initially with BBC Radio. And then in 1990, when Eurosport was essentially founded, to become a broadcaster in Eurosport, multiple language, but also Eurosport was being transmitted across Europe as a pan-European broadcaster. So Formula One and Andrew Marriott initially, then Adard Kalf, he and I would then do the broadcasts. And you could get, as long as you had a satellite dish, you could get Eurosport Formula One coverage in English language pretty much anywhere over Europe and, in fact, beyond Europe, which ultimately became the reason why I think Eurosport were unable to continue as a broadcaster because they were paying one sanctioned fee but broadcasting to about 25 or 30 countries. Yeah.
So you never dropped in that black hole many sportsmen are supposed to drop when they do, when they have just an ordinary life all of a sudden.
I think the contrast between being, first of all, as a Grand Prix driver or in a sport, if you're at the top of that particular sport, and then the cold turkey experience where you drop into, as you describe, the black hole, is quite severe.
Mm.
And unless you've been very clever in your preparation and planning, and maybe somebody like Jackie Stewart, for example, who knew at the end of 1973 that he was going to stop racing, he would have competed, had he competed at Watkins Glen that year in 100 Grand Prix, he felt that was the right time to step back, to stop being a racing driver, but he had built up a potential career with his association with, you know, great brands like Ford Motor Company, Goodyear, Moët Chandon, Rolex, and many others. So when he stopped racing, the only difference in his life was he wasn't actually physically getting into a racing car, but he was still associated in and around motor racing, and still is for that matter.
When we look back to the beginnings of your career, it was not a straightforward career. 1 year Formula 3, 1 year Formula 2, then Formula 1. I think you had been 4 or 5 years in Formula 2, about before you then entered Formula 1 with a private team, Hexagon.
Yes.
Yeah.
I mean, I started my career in 1970. I bought a Brabham BT40, Brabham BT30, a family exercise. So it was through my family that we were able to buy the car and set off in the European Formula 2 Championship.
So you remember how expensive it was?
Well, at the time, it was pretty expensive for my family. Mm. But in relative terms, yeah, it was probably about £15,000 or something.
Okay. Yeah.
But the beauty of Formula 2 at that time was it was a mixture of up-and-coming young drivers and established Grand Prix stars. And I think that's one of the best series that was ever held at an international level. So in my first race in 1970 at Thruxton, there were two heats and then a final, I find myself on the front row of the grid alongside Jochen Rindt, who was on pole position, and Jackie Eakes. Mm-hmm. And this was, I mean, just surreal that, you know, somebody who'd come from Northern Ireland, which didn't have a history of international motorsport at a driver level, other than one or two drivers in the 50s. And here I am on the front row of a grid with a man who is, you know, the king of Formula 2 and another king of motor racing, Jackie Eakes. And then another accident occurred, and that set me back. So I went back and regrouped and raced 71. Mm. In 72, a formula changed, and it meant that we weren't able to continue. It was just beyond our means. So I find myself back in Northern Ireland in my father's motor business, pretty unhappy and feeling that this is unfinished business. I've still got something more I want to exploit and see how far I can get. And at the end of 72, there was a race at Brands Hatch called the Victory Race. And that was a race in which I drove an unusual Formula One car, which was based on a March 721, but had been bought by Henerici from Eifeland.
Yep, Eifeland, yeah.
And Rolf Stommelen raced the car. I had this very futuristic bodywork by Coloni. So the car came a very strange route. It's a story in itself. But anyway, it got prepared by Hexagon, ran at Brands Hatch, and ended up finishing sixth. Mm. I thought, that's pretty good for a first Formula One race. And thereafter, that was the beginning of my career. And in terms of Formula One, it should have happened in real terms in 73. But again, another accident at Brands Hatch in early 73
set me back. Yeah, we come back later to that. Yeah.
So the two accidents set me back. Mm. But nevertheless, I was either too stupid to know when to stop or too determined not to stop. Mm. So I kept going, and by dint of commitment and self-belief, I suppose, managed to get a career in Formula One, beginning with Hexagon for a full season in 1974.
Yeah, and then Bernie, I think he even offered you a works drive for one or two races, wasn't it?
Well, in 73, I did the final race at Watkins Glen in the third Brabham, which was the car Andrea De Adamich would have normally driven. And in 74, the Hexagon solution suited Bernie because I was under contract to Bernie at that time. So it enabled him to fulfill any obligation to me. And at the same time, it enabled me to start a Formula One career, which I hope would, you know, develop and expand in a small private team, very well run, well, you know, financially well financed, but with no extras, which is what you could do at that time. Mm. And you had a number of private teams, Hesketh being maybe the one that most people were familiar with. You build a small team, bring in good people, you get a good driver, a great driver like James Hunt, and with a relatively small budget, you can be very effective amongst, you know, those teams that are the established Formula One teams of the day.
Yeah, Surtees was then a setback, I guess.
No, it wasn't. Not? I mean, on the other hand, I mean, at the end of 74, again, because of the escalation and costs, and the reality was that the likelihood of a team being able to maintain as a single car entrant to find sponsorship was difficult. So Hexagon were looking at running two cars. Mm-hmm. And there was a discussion going on either with, I think it might have been with Gitane or Elf or Mutel, I'm not sure. Certainly it was a French backer. And the idea would have been to run two cars, with the second car possibly being driven by Jean-Pierre Beltoise. Mm-hmm. But at the end of 74, nothing had materialized, and Paul had to ring me and say, look, John, I can't continue as we are. You know, the budgets are getting larger. We don't have the funding to do it. And they had to withdraw. So this happened, you know, a few weeks before Christmas. And all of a sudden, the dream looked like it was all over again.
Yeah.
But because I'd been driving for John Surtees in 1974 in Formula 2, and I got on very well with John and liked him, and I think he was a very misunderstood personality and man. So I got a phone call saying, look, you're out of a drive. I've got a car. I'm going to run a one-car team initially. I don't have a driver because Jochen Mass had gone and Carlos Pache had gone. And in 74, there was a fatal accident. Helmut Koenig had a terrible accident at Watkins Glen, who would have been John's driver in 75. So would you drive for me? I said, yes, couldn't wait. Because my view was it's better to be in a Formula One car and doing your best and being seen to do your best than it is of sitting back at home waiting for the phone to ring from a Brabham or a McLaren or a Ferrari or whatever. Mm. So I grabbed the opportunity with both hands, and I think it was a very wise and sensible move. It enabled me to continue racing, and I had some good races. Unfortunately for John, again, running as a single car and finding sponsorship to maintain and to move forward to develop. The Surtees at that time was an older design, and the car that John subsequently produced, which was very much like a Brabham with the slab sides, mm-hmm. wasn't available in 75. Would have been available in 76. So I took the opportunity, drove for John in most of the Grand Prix, the exceptions being Germany, where I drove for Colin Chapman in a Lotus 72 as a one-off. And then at Monza, John didn't enter a car either. So I went to Nürburgring again, but I did a inter-series race with Alfa Romeo. And then towards the end of the year, following on the tragic accident for Mark Donohue, I'd been close and friendly with Hans Hofer, who was the team manager of Roger's team. And just two people hit it off. Mm-hmm. And Hans had mentioned that, you know, we don't know what we're going to be doing in 76. We don't know whether Mark wants to continue or not, because I think he felt that Formula One is a specialty in itself. It's not as if it would be based back in America where you're in your home turf. So I think Mark might have considered not continuing in 76. And Hines was feeling out my views, would I be interested in driving for Roger if the opportunity arose? And through Mark's accident, then that opportunity came forward. And again, I was over the moon with the opportunity and accepted it.
And then something happened which doesn't happen anymore today. A midfield team won with you at the Österreichring in Zurich.
I mean, I call that period, the 70s, the good old days. And I think people sometimes mistake the good old days because it was a period when there was a lot of bad accidents, a lot of drivers badly hurt, drivers lost their lives. I wasn't referring to the good old days in that context. What was good about them was that people, anybody, and Hexagon did it, Hesketh did it, other teams did it, Frank Williams did it, basically. You go to Cosworth, buy your engines, you go to Hewland or whoever, buy your gearboxes, you engage a young engineer designer, and you sit down and you've got a very, very small budget in reality, and you build yourself a team. And you could do that. And I mean, Roger decided that he was going to come into Formula One. And at the same time, Val's Parnelli over in California with Parnelli Jones and Val Melicic.
Yep.
They built a car with Maurice Philippe, who designed the Lotus 72. So you could do those things. And even a more glaring example was that the Fittipaldi brothers thought they could build a Formula One car and finance it and run it with Brazilian expertise and whatever out of Brazil.
Yeah.
I mean, that was maybe taking it a bit too far. But certainly what Roger did was he built a facility down on the south coast of England in a place called Poole, and he engaged Jeff Ferris, who had been at Brabham, and Jeff was one of the people that worked under Gordon. So he was very knowledgeable in terms of car dynamics, what you had to do to build what would be a relatively simple Formula One car by today's standards. Roger secured the backing and the finance, and basically the Penske machine, which back in the middle 70s was in its infancy by today's standards, but Roger had a vision about where he hoped to go in his industrial and commercial world, and motorsport was a part of that. Mm. And the purpose of motorsport was it was a carrot to catch a donkey. It was a way of networking with high-income companies to attract them to motorsport, to enable him then to maybe have access to getting more deals. I mean, Roger has done a phenomenal job in his industrial commercial life, as well as he's done in his racing life.
Yeah. Why did he want you to shave off your beard after this victory?
There wasn't any contract per se, but I'd had this beard since about 68 or 69, and this was middle 70s, and I was getting fed up with the damn thing anyway. Mm. And I would like to have shaved it. But at the point when I went to drive for Roger, he ran a team which would be, I would describe as an Ivy League team. I think he was the first person who really appreciated the importance of the appearance of a car, the appearance of the team members, the team uniforms. Everything was up to a new level. Mm-hmm. And a part of that was most of the members of the team would have had relatively neat haircuts. Remember, in the middle 70s, you're in a period of not quite hippie, but yeah. I mean, my hair was quite long mm-hmm. at the time, but not gross. I had a beard. Now, Roger never said, Jan, I want you to shave the beard.
Yeah.
But I knew that it was something that he would have been happier had I not had a beard. So one way or the other, I broached the subject and said, look, the beard. When we win a Grand Prix, I promise you, I will shave the beard off. Mm. Shook hands on it. So it was a little side issue. Yeah. It was never an issue. Roger never once said, I want you to shave your beard.
I understand you.
So it was a mutually agreed deal. And after Austria 76, Roger, Heinz and I, we flew back to London that night. Roger was flying out the following morning. So we agreed to meet in the coffee shop for a breakfast before Roger got his flight. I got into my room. The first thing I did was go into the bathroom, get a razor out, and I shaved it off. Mm. And it was a bit of a shock because 1976 was an extremely hot summer, certainly in the UK. So you had a lot of colour. You're quite brown. And all of a sudden, there's a big white patch all around it. So, Jesus wept. That is not a good look.
Yeah.
But came down for breakfast in the morning, and I was down before Roger and Heinz. So I'm sitting in the coffee shop, and Roger and Heinz walk in, and I hear Roger saying, where's Watson? Where's Watson? Well, I went, over here, Roger, over here. Where is he? Where is he?
Yeah.
And he didn't expect me to do it as quickly as I did it, but I just frankly couldn't wait to get rid of the bloody thing.
I mean, you had to go then to Brabham in 77.
Yes.
Why Penske shut down after such a successful year?
Again, it was an escalation in the size of the team. I think it became, I'm not sure if it was a requirement or not, but for the team to go forward, they were looking at running a two-car team. Then there was going to be an escalation in costs and requirements, budgetary requirements. One thing that Roger, I feel like, I mean, he's never said this to me, but this is my view, is that he gave his sponsors a lot of bangs for their bucks. Mm-hmm. In reality, he probably gave them more bangs for their bucks than any other European team did. But as I say, the purpose of this in part was it was a way of networking into high-profile, high-status companies in North America. So get them on board, and then when they're on board, I can do business with them. So there was going to be an escalation. But secondly, I think Roger was in the process of building the corporation. Likewise, he was racing an IndyCar, which was a very important part of his American racing programs. And he'd entered into NASCAR. He had also been in Trans Am a little bit earlier in the 70s. And at the end of the day, he's a human being after all, even though he is a Superman. The number of days in his life that he can take off to fly across to Europe or wherever it is to attend a Grand Prix, and then fly back on the Monday morning and get stuck in again. Mm. And it was an expedient decision, I think, okay. ultimately. I think financially was a part of it, but I think the expediency was, look, I can only do so much. I'm fundamentally, my market is North America. Mm-hmm. And he pulled the plug, literally pulled the plug okay. one night yeah. when I got a phone call about 2 o'clock in the morning. And I mean, Roger's voice was, it was just, I've never heard him speak like that ever in all the years I've known him. His disappointment for himself, but for me. And of course, again, it was late in the year when it occurred. So what do you do?
Yeah.
So following morning, I rang Heinz down at Poole. Heinz said, come down here now. Let's see what we can do. Went down to the workshop. And Heinz and I sat down and looked at the options. The best option was Brabham. An alternative was Shadow, which was the lesser option by probably a significant amount. So Heinz rang Bernie. He said, Bernie, I'm just letting you know that Rogers pulled out of Formula One. And Bernie said, no, don't be silly. Don't take the piss. Mm. And it took about 5 minutes before the message finally got through that Roger, the team is over, Formula One is over, that's it. Mm. And Heinz said, I need to get John into your car for 1977. So Bernie said, all right, well, come up to my apartment. He had a lovely apartment overlooking the Thames, and drove up there. And my manager, then we met up and went to Bernie's apartment about 7 o'clock, sat down, discussed the issues. And within about half an hour, an agreement was concluded. Mm-hmm. But there was a problem, because the following morning, Clay Regazzoni was due to land at London Heathrow to be met by Herbie Blash, to go to the factory, to sign a contract. And the reason this had all happened is because Martini Rossi had pressured Bernie to put in a driver of their preference, which was Clay. Mm-hmm. Bernie wasn't very keen. He's never been very keen on having a sponsor dictate or pressure which driver should drive his cars. So this served Bernie very well, on the one hand. It served me well. And he got somebody, you know, at a value which had been below the market value, because suddenly I didn't have any real options and he was holding all the cards. But again, the more important thing was to get into a car which I had hoped would be a competitive car and in a team with which I had confidence. You know, Gordon Murray, I've got unbounding regard and respect for, and I still am to this day, abidingly fond of the BT44, which I raced in the second part of 74, because it was by far and away the first really outstanding Formula One car I had driven. And when you drive a really great Formula One car and then you compare it to some of the other cars, you realize why those cars win or why certain drivers win in those cars.
Probably the most extreme car in that period you ever drove was the fan car. Can you say a little bit about that car? How different was it to all the others?
The fan car was Gordon Murray's answer to Colin Chapman's Grand Effect car. So the layout of the BT46, it was never going to be a Grand Effect car, because first of all, it was a triangulated monocoque, which were very good reasons why it was, but not for Grand Effects. Secondly, it had a horizontally opposed flat 12 engine, not very good for Grand Effects. So Gordon, I don't know what the thought process he had, but certainly he's got a very vivid mind. And he would have remembered, certainly, when Jim Hall built the Chaparral 2H, I think it was, where there was an auxiliary engine on the back. It was a Can-Am car. And that auxiliary engine drove a fan at the back of the car. Mm-hmm. And the car was sealed with Lexan skirts. And it was an animal. Mm-hmm. It was a phenomenal car. I mean, it was way ahead of anything else. But in Formula One, there's a 3-litre engine capacity limit. So that restricted you putting another engine on. So Gordon very cleverly came up with a design which involved incorporating a fan at the back of the car, which was driven through the gearbox and through various bits and pieces, and mounted the radiators, or the water radiator, I think it was, on the top of the engine. And with a very, I would say, judicious interpretation of the rules and regulations, came up with a view that the primary purpose of the fan was to draw air through it to cool the engine.
Yeah. Mm.
Of course, this was all done in great secrecy, and it was only really a few weeks before the car raced in Anderstorp that any of us, Nicky or I, were fully aware of it. So when the car appeared, we did some tests, some in England, I think one in Italy. And what the car did was generate downforce related to the engine speed and effect. So with a conventional ground effect car, the downforce is the square of the speed, whatever. The quicker you go, the bigger the downforce. With the fan car, the benefit that it had was that its performance in low speed corners at, say, 10 or 12,000 RPM in a given gear was the same as you'd have had in sixth gear at the same RPM, except in sixth gear you'd have the benefit of all the other aerodynamic devices in the car. And in a circuit like Anderstorp, which has got relatively low speed corners, slightly banked parabolic corners, it enabled the car to have more bite and grip at those lower speeds than the Lotus 79 had. And it worked. Mm. I mean, it in its initial conception, it was what it was. Given three more months, it would have probably reached the levels of ground or downforce, which would have been unimaginable in that time. Yeah. And would have far exceeded what Chapman would have done with the 79. And during that weekend, I mean, Chapman was going nuts. I mean, he was absolutely fit to be tied. Mario, you know, was little doppelganger behind him. Yap, 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 yap. Mm. That car's throwing rocks out of the back. Somebody's going to get killed. Mm. You know, a load of bullshit, frankly. Yeah.
I mean, in your Brabham years, you've got a kind of an image that you are attracting bad luck. You could have won Argentina. Then it didn't happen because of technical reasons. Yeah. You could have won, obviously, France in 78.
Absolutely.
Yeah. Did you feel that you were a guy attracting bad luck?
No, not particularly. I mean, again, reliability in general in Formula One in the 70s was a totally different level to the reliability that Formula One in present days can produce. So it was more an issue about, I think, the engineering and the quality of the engineering or the quality of the materials and the parts. Maybe some of it was design. Mm. And certainly in 77, there were opportunities. I mean, Argentina was one case, Dijon in 77, Silverstone in 77. And even in Belgium in 77, I only got as far as the chicane at the back of the pits.
Yeah.
And Mario, who was on pole in the Lotus, I got the jump at the start, and then screwed up his braking around the back of me and knocked me out. So there were possibly two or three races, maybe more, if you look back on it, that would have certainly given me an opportunity to stand on the winner's podium.
Yeah.
And the thing with Dijon particularly wasn't a mechanical issue per se. It was either there wasn't sufficient fuel put into the car because there's been a miscalculation, or I don't know what else it could have been, frankly. Mm. And then at Silverstone, the following Grand Prix, a fuel problem again arose. And that may have been because some of the valves and the fuel tanks, because there's five separate fuel tanks in the fuel system. I think maybe one of those valves had been put in the wrong way around or something. So
okay.
Those were two races that for sure had my name written across them. Mm-hmm. The others you could dispute because, you know, in Argentina, Jody started 12th and finished first.
Yep.
So a lot of guys who were ahead of Jody, you know, also retired.
Mm. Then you went to McLaren and looking from nowadays, you could say initially it probably was a bad decision, but on the long term, it was absolutely the right way to go then.
Yes. I mean, again, the opportunity at McLaren came through the tragic loss of Ronnie Peterson at Monza. But to show you how, I might say, cynical Formula One can be, Ronnie's accident had occurred, and then the race restarted quite late in the afternoon. And by the time the race finished, and I'm back at the Brabham Hospitality, an emissary from Marlborough McLaren, John, we need somebody like to speak to you. So, okay. I went up to the McLaren Hospitality, and they said, look, Ronnie's obviously had a severe accident. He signed with us for 79. We don't know his condition. We don't know how long it will be before he's fit to race. We need to make contingency plans, and we want to talk to you. So I sat and gave them broad outlines. Yeah, I'd be loved to do it because McLaren are going to make a ground effect car. It's going to be an infinitely better car than the Lotus because of McLaren's reputation as a manufacturer. And, you know, the way they build cars was, in my view, a safer way than maybe Lotus had built cars. On the Monday morning, the news broke of Ronnie's death. So it was then a matter of going through the negotiations to secure a seat. But the car that McLaren designed, the M28, and it was a big disappointment to me, and obviously it was to the team. I think what they hadn't appreciated was, A, the levels of the downforce and the forces that were going into the car, into the chassis, and in terms of torsional rigidity and just, you know, the general rigidity of location for mounting points and whatever. So somewhere back at the end of October, the season's finished. I'm no longer a Brabham driver. The M28 has just been launched. We did a couple of runs at Silverstone, I think. And then the car was taken to Watkins Glen. Or maybe the other way around. Maybe we went to Watkins Glen. So got there. It's just the McLaren team and we're running the track. So I go out and do two or three laps or something just to bed the car in and come in and have a look. So the car goes back into what they call the tech centre at Watkins Glen. And about half an hour later, Alistair Caldwell says, OK, we're packing up, we're going back. What are you talking about, Alan? Don't be so stupid. No, we're going back. That's over. Test over. Why? Don't worry about it. Don't think about it. And what had happened was when they put the car up on the axle stands, the axle stands were behind the front wheels and ahead of the rear wheels. And when the car was up there, somebody noticed that the nose was beginning to droop, literally. It was doing that. So there was an inherent and integral rigidity or lack of rigidity. And the car was constructed of honeycomb, aluminium honeycomb, which has got great strength in certain ways, but the car was a very 90-degree section change. And anyway, the bottom line was the car was inherently, I would say, very unsafe. And it was then taken back, and it was then strengthened, but by every time they put something in the car to strengthen it, the weight went up and whatever. So that was one issue with the car, and probably the other issue was that I don't think McLaren fully understood aerodynamics. And while they did take the car at times to GM's, I think their Atlanta wind tunnel, the thinking at McLaren at that time was probably old school thinking, whereas what we had seen with, for example, with the Ligier when it came out, and what Gerard Ducarouge had done with that, was miles beyond anything. And then later in the season, what Williams were doing, and then what again Gordon Murray did with the BT49, which was the Cosworth version of the BT48. And all of a sudden, McLaren were not at the races.
Yeah.
And while they did immediately sit and train the design for the M29, what in effect they were doing was carrying over in part, not in total, but in part, the characteristic of the company in its design philosophies. And it was a much better car. It had better aerodynamics. It was stronger. But it didn't have the level of downforce that, for example, the Williams or the Ligier would have had. It probably had maybe 50% of what they had.
The McLaren MP1, which came then in 81, was obviously a much safer, better car.
Yeah.
Was that the first time you felt kind of safe in a racing car? I come back now to these accidents you mentioned in the beginning. I think you had an accident, you have to explain, in Brands Hatch, where I think you broke your leg and you were sitting for the half of the race in the car. Why didn't they extract you?
Well, when the BT42 came out, it had you could either have the rack, the steering rack, at the very front of the front bulkhead, or you could have it inwards, an internal rack, which was a choice an engineer would make. And again, it was, I had a small problem. The throttle wasn't shutting fully. So coming into Stirling's Bend, which is a slow left-hand corner, it pushed on. So the car understeered off. And it was what would have been a normal accident, so you knock the front wheel off. But because, again, the section change, where the steering rack was and where the foot box was a lot of strength at the steering rack and a relatively weak front end. So hit the barrier at that angle and the whole foot box rotated 90 degrees and my right leg went 90 degrees with it.
Mm.
So it was a small accident with a major consequence. But then to try and get me out of the car, what unfortunately the track workers, the marshals, weren't aware of was that the steering rack in parts is hardened. You know, it's there's a treatment you could do to make it very hard. And they were trying to cut through the hardened bit with regular bzzz, and just all that's happening, the blades were just blunting.
Mm.
And I was in the car probably the best part of an hour, trapped.
Yeah.
I couldn't get out. If the car had caught fire, I'd have been dead.
Mm.
So it was a small accident, but you know, it then led Gordon to strengthen that area of the car, because clearly, whatever had been the cause of the accident, the big concern was that the front of the car should not have reacted in the manner it did.
Mm.
So it was good for Brabham in one sense, but it was bad for me in another sense.
Yeah, and in Monza, he had a big accident with the MP4.
Yeah.
And nothing happened to you.
No, well, I had one. Yes, that was my fault in the MP4.
Mm.
Coming out of Lesmo 2, I was running behind, I think it was maybe Alan Jones or whoever, and there was another car ahead, so I was trying to position myself at the exit of Lesmo. I didn't want to get too close to the car in front of me because I'd had to check up. So I wanted to get the run through the corner to come off the corner quicker than the two cars ahead of me, to then have a chance going down into a Scari chicane to maybe get an overtake on one of them at least. And I'm focusing on where I want to be down there, and I allowed the car to run fractionally too wide. So that at that time, you had these quite aggressive curbs on the edge of the corner. So I ran the wheels up the curb, but they got to the top of the curb and they fell over. So the bottom of the car then, the floor in the car was just doing, dun, 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 and it gradually began to rotate and it spun across the track and went into the barrier on the right-hand side. And it was a fairly major impact, but it was a bang. Oh. And then I saw an engine sliding across the racetrack. I thought, Jesus, whose engine is that?
Yeah.
I didn't realize it was mine.
Okay.
So the gearbox had got wedged in the barrier, it levered the engine off the back, and then the engine and gearbox had separated. So what happened was a big, big accident, but the integrity, the design and construction integrity that John Barnard had built into the car enabled me to step out of the car completely, I mean, nothing, not even a bruise. And it was the first time a major accident of that at that level had occurred with a carbon fiber chassis car. And I think it answered all the questions that maybe people had as to whether carbon fiber, that's one thing having a shunt at maybe 50 miles an hour at a low speed corner, but having a shunt at 120 or 30 miles an hour on a high speed corner is a different deal.
Yeah.
Car performed absolutely as it was designed to do.
Let's go finally now to the 2 years, 82 and 83. First of all, in 82, you met a teammate you had already.
Indeed.
At Brabham. Was it a different Niki Lauda in 82 than in 78?
I mean, the big thing about Niki in 78, when he came to Brabham, first of all, he just won a world championship. He won the second world championship. He had a personal sponsor called Parmalat, and he was instrumental in bringing Parmalat then as the team sponsor to Brabham. So in my stupidity or naivety, I hadn't appreciated the level of, on top of all the other values that Niki brought. I mean, forget about the commercial side, as a race driver and as an operator. I mean, an outstanding race driver, a very clever operator within a team, and being able to draw people and draw the team to him.
Mm-hmm.
So when he came to McLaren, it was a slightly different scenario. But I think he felt maybe I can orchestrate the same kind of, I'll have John in control, no problem. And there was a different attitude, I think, in McLaren, albeit there was undoubtedly a honeymoon period, because the first three races were, or he had a contract for three races. If it didn't work for either party, Niki could have walked away. Or they could have dropped him, whichever. Mm-hmm. But it worked very well because Nicky won in Long Beach. And so there's this kind of honeymoon period going on, loving, all this, you know, whatever. At this point, my car is being run by Teddy Mayer, and Alan Jenkins likewise is having an input into it as well. And what Teddy understood about me was that if he can create this set, the kind of car that works for me, I can be quite an effective race driver. So we ended up doing certain things at different events, and certainly in Belgium in 82, which was the sad weekend when Villeneuve lost his life. Mm-hmm. On the Sunday morning, it was quite warm, abnormally warm. Had gone out on the normal Michelin tire that I would use. Nicky would use the slightly softer option because he thought he could, his driving skill and style would make that tire more effective. So I went out and did a few laps, came in and said, balance is okay, but the left front's beginning to push. I don't have that bite or continuity and consistency. And predominantly a right-hand corner circuit. So Teddy stood there and there's a rack of tires in the garage and he turned to one of the guys and said, put those tires up, see those tires up there? Put those on the left-hand side of John's car. I said, what are those, Teddy? What tires are those, Teddy? No. But what are they, Teddy? Tell me, I want to know what those tires are. So he explained them. He said, those are the tires that Giacomelli had used in Las Vegas at the end of 81. And they had been fantastic for the teams that used them. I said, no fucking way. Mm. So we had an argument in the car and I'm cursing Teddy high up and low down. And he's saying, now, John, you know, he's doing this to the wrist and all the Teddy.
Yeah.
So, all right, Teddy, put the tires on. So I was negative. I went out negatively because I now had an imbalance between compounds left to right. Went out down the pit lane, and I've always believed that you can tell very quickly, even before you get on a racetrack, if something's going to be right, you tend to get some messages. So I drove down the pit lane, still negative, onto the racetrack, up to turn one, but then to turn two. And it's feels a little bit funny, but it wasn't that bad. And so I do an out lap on the tire, and then go on to flying lap. And it's not bad. And then the second flying lap, actually, it's okay. So did three or four flying laps, came in and said, Wiener, Teddy, two thumbs up.
Yeah.
Because if as long as it stays warm, the ambient's high, the track temperature's high, let's do it. Mm. Because now I had a tire on the left front that didn't give up either on entry, mid-corner or exit. Balance was great. And after the morning session, because Nicky and I were both in the garage at the same time, and he's going, you know, and I'll not do his accent out of courtesy to him. Mm. Yeah, what do you do? I said, what I did, you should do. I'm telling you now, I'm going to piss past you because you're going to end up understeering off the racetrack. And if you don't do what I've done, you're nuts. Mm-hmm. You're nuts. Oh, what have you done? Went through this whole scenario for about 10 minutes. So I said, all right, I've never lied to you. Mm. I've never tried to do any tricks. I'm telling you now, what are you going to do? And he said, and he gave me an insight into his whole, if you like, his philosophy, not just for motor racing, but for lots of other things he's done in his life. I'm not going to do it. And I said, you're nuts. You're mad. I said, why? Tell me why. Mm. Tell me why.
Yeah.
And I'm jabbing my finger at my... And he said, I haven't tried it. Mm. I went, Eureka. I've learned something. I've gained an advantage. I've forced him to tell me why, which probably he would never have wanted to do. Mm. And he knows. Mm. He knew what I had said was 100% correct. Mm. And it was a mantra, I think, that Nicky operated a lot of his life through, certainly his motor racing, and clearly when he was flying an aircraft, he was probably the best pilot, either commercial or private, I've ever flown with, because everything he did was correct by the book.
Okay.
That's how you get results. Mm. I did a Maverick thing, which was maybe more of my character and nature.
Which won you the Grand Prix.
Which won the Grand Prix.
Yeah, yeah.
But his rationale and logic said, you might be right, you could be right, or as it happens, you were right.
Yeah.
But because he hadn't tried it, he couldn't do it.
Yeah.
And he couldn't bring himself to go against that fundamental value which he basically ran his life by.
Yeah. In this year, you could have won the championship. You were in the mix in the last race. Nicky was not. Did you really believe there was a real chance? I think Keke only had to finish fifth or something like that.
Yeah. I mean, it was an opportunity missed. It was a year in which probably up to a dozen drivers at one time or another could have been a contender. The championship should have been won by either a Renault or a Ferrari driver, but for reasons they didn't. And then Nicky and I both won two races that year. Keke won one. Jacques Lafitte was amongst the drivers. It was an opportunity lost, in part, maybe some team calls, things I did in the car. I mean, Hockenheim had a problem going into the chicane, back locked up and went off. That should have been a race. I would have picked up certainly 6 points, which would have been enough by the time we got to Las Vegas to win the championship. Keke won the championship. He won one race, but he finished a lot of races and picked up points because of that. The interesting thing, and again, it's very much a reflection, we get to Las Vegas, and it was only really by the time we got to Las Vegas that Nicky suddenly realized that McLaren is never going to be his team in the way that Ferrari was, or maybe Brabham was, because Ron went to him on the Saturday night and said, listen, Nicky could have won the championship, but he was further back in the line of drivers than I was. And he said, John is better placed than you in the championship. If he's behind you and he's coming through, will you let him go past without stopping him? Oh. I don't know how many times in his life he'd ever been asked to do that. Probably not very many.
Yeah.
And I think what he realized was that McLaren is a team that's not about the drivers, it's about the team. And you look through Ron's history with the team, it has always been McLaren first, second, and third. It's been always about the brand, the name, the team. And I think Nicky went to bed on Sunday or Saturday night, switched off. He went through the motions of the race. Couldn't wait to get on the plane to fly back home again.
Mm.
And at that point, I think, was the first time that he realized that whatever the clout that he could bring, either through commercial connections, you know, Philip Morris Marlborough, or other possibilities, or all this love-in, you know, the sort of love-in that took place in early 82.
Mm.
It's not about me. It's only about the team, as far as Ron is concerned. And also, not be under any misunderstanding. No driver in McLaren, be it at that time or up until Ron's, you know, last years in the team, no driver should ever feel that's a job for life, because Ron always looked in the paddock. Who could I get that's better than the drivers I have?
Was that then the reason why he took Alain Prost in 84? I mean, you had more points in 83 than Nicky, I guess. Yeah. You had won a Grand Prix in Long Beach, this famous victory from the 22nd grid position. But Nicky always blamed you. No, you lost your place because you gambled too long with Ron. And then all of a sudden, Alain Prost came around the corner.
Nicky, he loved that story. But one point that's quite interesting, somebody told me recently, who in the three different seasons that we were teammates, which driver came out best in terms of points?
You.
No.
You mean altogether or season per season?
No, if you add together the points that we scored, I scored in 78, 82 and 83, and Nicky scored in 78, 82. Which driver came out on top?
Well, then it must be him.
No. Oh.
So equal?
Correct.
Really?
Yeah, 86 points.
Oh, good.
I didn't know that until a month or two ago.
Yeah. You lost your place at McLaren.
Okay, what's happened, and this is the truth, Nicky, for some reason, he seemed to lose a year. He was reflecting back on 82 rather than 83. Last race of the year is in Johannesburg, South Africa, at Kyalami. Tag Turbo. And there were two drivers who could win the world championship that year. Alain Prost, in my view, should have been the world champion, but for whatever reasons he didn't. And Nelson Piquet won a second world championship. It was a Saturday race. Everybody then flew back home to Europe on the Sunday, got in Sunday morning. I understand Alain was then summoned by the Renault team to come to the headquarters, whereupon he was fired.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know why. And I'm sure there are reasons why, but no one's ever given a specific and clear answer to that, why he was fired. So Alain, I understand, then immediately got in touch with Philip Morris, John Hogan, and said, I've been fired. Can you get me a seat at Ferrari? And John, I understand, said, no, the seats at Ferrari are now confirmed. There's no space available, but we have a space at McLaren. Alain said, I understand. Well, you've got Nicky and John.
Mm.
And the response was, Nicky's under contract for 84. John's out of contract for 84. We would like to talk to you. And I then got a call from Nicky, I think on Monday morning, saying, be careful. Alain's trying to get your seat. The reality was, once it was known that Alain was available, from a McLaren perspective, and probably for Philip Morris likewise, it was a no-brainer.
Mm.
You know, I was a driver at that time. I was 37, coming 38. Nicky was 35-ish, 36. Two senior drivers, both of whom could at any point over the next year or so step back and retire. And a driver of Alain's potential would be lost. So it was a no-brainer, literally, in the sense that he's available. He's going to have to be, I believe, compensated by Renault for... I think he was still under contract for 84 at Renault. And they were able to get him at a bargain basement price, with the potential of Alain being with the team for the next 2, 3, 4 years,
yeah.
Whatever.
Yeah.
So simply, it was, if you like, in that I benefited in end of 76 going to Brabham for 77, and poor Clay Regazzoni lost out. And then end of 83, 84... Alain got the drive for 84 and I lost out. If I had been in the position of McLaren as a team principal, you're being Ron or whoever, I would have done the same thing.
Mm-hmm.
Because as a commercial and business opportunity, if you hadn't done that and you'd said, oh, let's stick with Nicky and John, they're nice guys, we know them,
mm-hmm.
You know, they do a good job. Formula One isn't like that. It's about dog eat dog. And that was an example of dog eat dog.
Okay, that's a good word at the finish. John, I think I could talk to you now for hours. So maybe we do a chapter 2 next year, in a year's time,
and problem.
We talk about all the things we were missing now. Thank you
Pleasure.
Very much that you had been our guest, or we had been guests here in your home. And liebe Zuschauer, ich darf mich auch verabschieden. Bis zum nächsten Mal. Servus.
Wenn euch auch diese Folge Formel Schmidt gefallen hat, würden wir uns freuen, wenn ihr den Podcast abonniert, bewertet und ihn weiterempfehlen würdet. So können wir noch mehr Formel 1 begeisterte Menschen erreichen. Vielen Dank und bis zum nächsten Mal.